headlines, Israeli authorities approved the construction of more than 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. The Taliban propose a three-month ceasefire with the Afghan government in return for the release of 7,000 militant prisoners. And floods and heavy rain in western Germany leave at least 19 people dead and dozens of others missing. Hello and welcome everybody. Israel's new prime minister has relaunched a controversial project for the construction of over 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. The so-called E1 project involves the construction at an unbuilt area of the occupied land. It cuts land access between Palestinian inhabited territories in the West Bank, rendering any future unified Palestinian state unviable. Former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also tried to advance the project, but it was halted under pressure from the international community, the Palestinian Authority, and rights groups. The project is also expected to draw objections from Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's left-wing coalition partner, as well as the U.S. All Israeli settlements on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Mona Kendil has given us more details on the new Israeli settlement project in the occupied West Bank.
Those 3,412 new settler units would be built in the occupied West Bank, mainly in one of the biggest Israeli settlements known as Ma'ale Adonim. These settlements are part of the E1 project that would be linking some West Bank cities with East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, allowing settlers to move freely from the Ma'ale Adonim settlement and the settlements around it to inside Jerusalem, Al-Quds, however, separating Palestinian villages and towns and cities. It would be separating the central of the occupied West Bank from northern the occupied West Bank. And this, of course, would be very difficult for the Palestinians. According to experts and anti-settlement groups, what we have read this morning, that this might lead to a new conflict or a possible conflict between the American administration and the Israeli regime, because it seems that the U.S. administration is trying to convince the Israelis not to declare about major settlement projects that would be bringing some problems, whether to the Israeli regime and to the Israeli Prime Minister Bennett himself.
For more on that story, we're now joined by Palestinian activist Amal Wahdan, who's with us from Ramallah. Ms. Wahdan, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on this E1 project and its repercussions, please.
Yes, the E1 project actually is going to be started in the West Bank lands, occupied lands, and in East Jerusalem as well. There is, as we mentioned before, and we usually repeat the same thing, there is no difference between Netanyahu and Bennett when it comes to the settlement project. The Zionist settlement movement is just the same. It's behind all these settlement projects. So the E1 in the West Bank is a continuation of what's going on in Jerusalem as well. It's going to be actually stealing more lands from the Palestinians in the neighborhoods surrounding the old city of Jerusalem, as well as other places, other cities and other lands in the occupied West Bank. So the project is a continuation of previous process and previous movement. When we compare the settlements in occupied territories before Oslo and after Oslo, we can see that it jumped from 150,000 settlers to 800,000 to 1 million settlers in the West Bank. Of course, the settlement, the large settlement, it's continuing to expand, and what they call it, the temporary post settlement, caravan settlement, continues to be located in different parts of the West Bank. Jabal Sabih, for example, where we have this Palestinian uprising against the settlement and the settlers' organization there, is a very good example of this movement, actually, and the resistance of the people in Jabal Sabih, in Sabih Mountain, is similar to the resistance movement in Jerusalem and different parts of the West Bank. Now, there are 63 settlement organizations, Zionist settlement organizations, who are financed by U.S. American Jewish lobby, and who are also financed from the Israeli government and from the Israeli Knesset, the Israeli parliament. So these companies and these gangs of Zionist settlement organizations are working together hand in hand. Instead of having the army, for example, in the face of the people, they put these using weapons. It's like a paramilitary that is used by the government in order to continue the process of seizing and stealing more lands from the Palestinians. The Zionist project hasn't changed since the beginning of the last centuries up until now. It goes on and on. Only they change the style, they change the tone of their speech. Netanyahu was very clear, very obvious, like Trump in the U.S., while Biden wants things to be undercover, to be low profile. So the aim is the same, and the goal is the same. No more Palestinian land is left for the Palestinians. In 1948, for example, they took more land from the Palestinians, and they ended up with 78% of historic Palestine, compared to 22% for the Palestinians. And now, when we measure this 22%, it is being decreased to 10%, because they have the wall, the racist apartheid wall, which took lots of thousands and thousands of dirhams from the Palestinians, and they have that settlements. There is settlement councils now, major settlement councils in the West Bank. We have Aksyon in the south, where it covers mostly Beit Lahab and Hebron area. We have Ma'ale Adumim, which seized like 4 to 5 hills or small mountains from the Palestinians. And we have a real settlement in the north, where it's always mentioned settlements and new settlement force.
Very well.
So it will never end. And the U.S. is managing the crisis of the Palestinians. It's not going to be solved. No peace process. No Palestinian state for the Palestinians. We are now in the phase, or in a new phase, or a new diplomacy carried by the U.S.
Very
to
well.
Deceive the Palestinians and the public opinion.
All right. Thanks a lot. Palestinian activist Amal Wadon speaking to us from Ramallah. Elsewhere, the Israeli military says it has arrested some 30 Palestinian students after they visited the house of a Hamas prisoner, which the regime demolished last week. The military has accused the students of being terror operatives. It claims they transferred money for the Hamas resistance movement and organized its activities in Judea and Samaria. The students are from Beer Zeit University in the occupied West Bank. The university has condemned their detention, calling it, quote, a violation of all international laws and norms that guarantee students' right to freedom of movement. It also called on the international community to intervene immediately to secure their release. Hamas has described the Israeli move as a miserable attempt to harm the spirit of resistance among Palestinians and their support for the families of prisoners, martyrs, and the wounded. The Taliban have proposed a three-month ceasefire in return for the release of about 7,000 of their members held in Afghan jails. A militant group also has wanted the names of its leaders to be removed from a UN blacklist. An Afghan government negotiator involved in peace talks with the Taliban has called it a big demand. The development comes as the militants have stepped up their attacks on cities and villages, taking a swath of territories under their control since May. They've also captured several border crossings, including with Pakistan, Iran, and Turkmenistan. The Afghan military has launched offensives to retake the areas captured by the militants. Dozens of Taliban militants have reportedly been killed in operations. Our correspondent Amin Alami is joining us now from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Amin, tell us more about this proposal put forth by the Taliban, also about the offensive against the advance of the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Ministry of Peace affirms the Taliban has declared their readiness to say yes to peace via approving a three-month ceasefire offer to the Afghan government. And Nader Naderi, a member of the Afghan negotiator team with the Afghan, with the Taliban, says that this proposal is being offered by the Taliban in order to, as a show of goodwill, to follow the Afghan issues via peaceful manners and via peaceful options, not stressing on waging further war in Afghanistan. But in the meantime, many here believe that the real goal behind the declaration of such issue by the Taliban is to gain more time to fully control the captured areas they have captured over the past months. This comes as the Taliban militants have captured dozens of districts across Afghanistan, as well as some key border areas in northern, western, and northwestern parts of the country. And many others also believe that the Taliban are after releasing the 7,000 Taliban inmates from Afghan jails in order to strengthen the military wings and front against the Afghan military forces, who are strongly pounding the Taliban militants' positions, according to Afghanistan's defense ministry. But in the meantime, the peace offer, ceasefire offer by the Taliban militants comes as top political officials here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, believes that there is no way to bring peace and stability in Afghanistan via military options, and that the Taliban needs to pay attention and respect the demands of, the demand of the Afghan people that is bringing peace and stability to this country and putting an end to decades-long violence and bloodshed. However, this is also important to not forget that Taliban, of course, have foreign backers, according to the Afghan government and many observers here. The Afghan government has repeatedly directly blamed its eastern neighbor Pakistan for being involved in directly supporting terrorism and destabilizing Afghanistan via backing Taliban, supporting them and financing and helping them to launch military operations inside Afghanistan. In such circumstances, many here believe that the Afghan government firstly need to talk to the such backers of the Taliban militant group and firstly directly resume the intra-Afghan talks with the Taliban militants in order to bring peace in this country. However, the Afghan government also declared that a group of top government officials, former Afghan officials, including Afghan President Hamid Karzai, the Afghanistan's Marshal General Abdurrashid Dostum, former jihadi leaders Karim Khalili, as well as Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, and the security advisor to President Ghani, Muhammad Mohaqiq, along with many other well-known political figures, are going to go to Doha to resume with the Afghan Taliban.
All right, thanks a lot. Amin Alami joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Elsewhere, the Cuban president has called for peace, harmony, and respect amid anti-government protests across the nation.
To overcome disagreements between all of us, we have to encourage each other to try and find solutions, even if we sometimes have different points of view on certain issues or different situations.
Miguel Diaz-Canel once again blamed the United States for the anti-government protests over the economic downturn. In his country, Havana says the economic crisis has been caused by a half century of Washington sanctions and embargo. Meanwhile, Cuba restored internet access and temporarily lifted restrictions on the amount of food and medicine the travelers could bring into the country. The moves were an apparent concession to demands by protesters who took to the street last weekend. One person has died and more than 100 have been arrested in the anti-government protests so far. At least 19 people have been killed in western Germany after several houses collapsed following heavy rains and severe flooding. Police say dozens of people have also gone missing while many are stranded on rooftops. They say more houses are at the risk of collapse. Two firefighters have so far been killed while trying to help stranded people. Severe flooding has disrupted rail, road, and river transport, leaving many areas cut off in the region. At least 200,000 households are now left without power. Shipping has also been suspended on the Rhine River. The army has been deployed to help with rescue operations. Evacuation orders have been issued for parts of the region. The German Weather Service has forecast more heavy rains for the next 2 days. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing The House on Cocoa Road, directed by Damani Baker. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Telegraph, The Guardian, and many others. And alongside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, The House on Cocoa Road is the story of director Damani Baker's family, particularly about his mother's story, Fanny Houghton, who moved her children from Oakland, California, to participate in the Granada Revolution, only to find her family in harm's way of a U.S. military invasion. This film also sheds light on the history of Black Power movements and their struggle for racial equality.
I call the United States home, but this country has a painful legacy of violence that we still struggle to confront.
I think we always have to find something that holds a promise, and that way we look toward the future.
You're committed to humanity, to making the world a better place. You know, not just for your family, but everybody's family. We were trying to make sense of this world.
One of the most important things that has to be done in the process of carrying out a revolutionary struggle is to merge the personal with the political, where they're no longer separate.
You have this situation where we are trying to build a new society.
Grenada is the southernmost of the Windward Islands in the West Indies.
Here's our revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was a utopia.
And the next thing I knew, she was packing you all up.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy.
I took my young children out of my country to come here to help this country. I left in pain. This is the first time I've been back, so you've got to be very sensitive.
I remember you asking me, as the bombs dropped and the island shook, you said this must be what they call war.
There is a freedom tide rising in our hemisphere. The spirit of democracy is assuming its rightful role as the great unifier of the people.
They're shooting! They're shooting!
My mother always said that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And if we work towards change, conditions will become different.
Long live peace in our Americas and in the world. Forward ever, backward never.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for joining the show. Now, this documentary gives you an insightful and historical look at race relations in the US and also offers an alternative look at the US-led invasion of Grenada, but from a Black perspective. And Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this film?
I think it's a very strong film. It's a very engaging film. I think what it does particularly well, there's a clip very early on where Angela Davis, the great Black activist, is saying, we need to make the personal political. And this is exactly what this film does. It starts with this opening montage of footage from various tapes that Damani Baker, the director, has found in, I think, the garage of his mother when he was moving her house, when she was moving house. Yeah, and you know, so you've got footage from, you know, 83, 99, 2015, all spliced together. And you get a sense of a young man, young filmmaker, piecing these disparate frames and images together, trying to work out what they represent. But it does so in a way that's incredibly casual. It doesn't feel like a serious history lesson. It feels like you've been invited over to someone's house on a Sunday morning. They're telling you about their family history over coffee and cake. It's sort of deceptively casual, but it does build to a much bigger picture of American life and Black American life in particular.
And Lee, if I could turn to you now, why is it important to revisit these topics? And we see like a trove of sort of documentaries coming out about Black Power movements, and we've covered quite a few on this show with the Black Panther Party and so forth. What relevance does it have today?
I think it's great relevance, and I think when you look at the historical film that we have, particularly with films like this, it's surprising how much contemporary resonance it has with the situation of African-American communities today in America. But it also speaks, I think, that film to a broader narrative. And it's this perpetual search within the African diaspora for that home, that place, that belonging. And wherever it is, from wherever our particular roots are, we have a deep need to be reconnected. And I think that what you're looking at is African Americans seeking to escape the predations of Jim Crow, you know, racism and its legacies in America, going to Grenada, and then finding themselves at the end of an imperialist gun. And I thought that was a powerful narrative. You've sought to escape racism, but actually you've ended up in a place where American imperialism has rolled up on the Grenadian shores with devastating consequences. And I also think the narrative about black women's leadership role in having to make decisions about their family, where they live, what quality of life they will likely, those are the kind of conversations that I think are, you know, very deep within black communities of, can we survive here? Will we prosper here? Will our children be treated equally?
That is a very important point to make, and this documentary certainly raises all those issues. It's also a very political film, as you alluded to also. I just want to talk a little bit now about the politics of the film before we move on. So on the one hand, Mike, the official US narrative of the invasion of Grenada was that Grenada's government was working with so-called communist Cuba and wanted to make a base there. And Ronald Reagan, the president at the time, quote, said it was necessary to bring the spirit of freedom and to Grenada in the form of a military strike. But of course, this documentary goes against this narrative, doesn't it, and offers a different perspective.
It does. I think it, what it succeeds in doing is presenting this counter, because Damani Baker realizes that when the family moves away from Grenada, goes back to the USA, the image that he sees of Grenada in American media is very different from the image that he saw growing up. And, you know, you're getting the sense that American news media presented Ronald Reagan as this great liberator. He went into Grenada and sorted the situation out, and all of a sudden it's much better for him doing that. And actually, Damani Baker, what he's done by making this film and piecing all these individual pieces of footage together that have been taken over the decades, what he's done is he's actually presented a very convincing counter-image to that claim, and the counter-image to what was the dominant image in American media at the time.
Mm. And I did a bit of more research actually on this topic because I found it really interesting the way this documentary brought it up. And it was reported that a senior British officer who watched the Grenada invasion from Barbados, Major Mark Adkin, he wrote afterwards, quote, that it was launched because of the intense desire of the president and his advisors to raise US prestige, particularly at home and in the armed forces, where morale and self-respect had fallen substantially since the Vietnam War. Lee, do you think that this was the real reason then behind the invasion?
Well, yeah, there's nothing like crushing a little country to, reinforce one's flagging self-esteem. So that's a narrative we've seen in world politics. But I also think that the you've got to remember that, you know, with Norman Manley in Jamaica at the time, that there was a very much sense that there might be a domino effect in relation to socialism, communism in the region.
The US perceived this as a threat?
The US perceived this as a very real threat that could see a swathe of Caribbean islands really moving to the left. Not far from their coast. And so a combination of hubris, arrogance, imperialism, and real genuine fear, I think, of the extent to which the Caribbean could be involved, fueled American ambition to try and stamp out any nascent light of an alternative socialist agenda in the arena.
Hello, my name is Damani Baker. I am the director of The House on Cocoa Road, a documentary about my mother. My mom moved my sister and I from Oakland, California, where I was born and raised, to take part in the Grenada Revolution. So this film was about how we ended up in Grenada in the first place, how we ended up in a country that eventually would be invaded by the United States as my family hid under a bed when bombs dropped all around us. In order to understand that, I had to go back and retrace my mother's history, her story of having parents who were part of the Great Migration West, great-grandparents who were sharecroppers in the South, how she served children in the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, and eventually became Angela Davis' teaching assistant at UCLA in the 60s. So this is a film about women leaders, it's about my mother, and it's about people who really imagined a better way to live.
So there's Damani Baker there himself speaking about the purpose of this film. And I think what's special about this documentary, and also quite unique, is that it offers, as well as being a political film, it offers an intimate look at Damani's personal life. What do you make of this sort of aspect of the film? Was it important?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it sort of falls into that kind of who do you think you are, that kind of the TV series where people look back into their roots. So it starts out as Damani Baker looking back and trying to figure out how on earth his family got here from there. So, you know, his great-grandmother was part of a sharecropping family in the American South, and there was Great Migration, then civil rights, you know, the advances in civil rights. And he's trying to piece out where he falls and how come that he, as a young filmmaker, you know, has the time, the leisure time, and the money to go around the world making movies, and you know,
even the title of the film, The House on Cocoa Road, has a personal touch, doesn't it?
Yes, it's trying to sort of pin down places in the past and to sort of plot, if you like, a sort of straight line. You know, how do we get here now in this moment, given everything that's gone before us, and given the indifference of white America to our family and our struggles? You know, how do we get through all that to get to where we are today? And you know, the archive footage is very important in sort of nailing down exactly where that family was at those particular times.
I suppose this is a very symbolic message then, Lee, that politics is kind of inseparable to black African Americans and their life and their struggle to the present day.
Absolutely, deeply intertwined, and we very much live our lives vicariously through those politics. But I think it's also an interesting narrative on the phenomenon of migration in the modern world, and how those migratory tales can be best be told by the sort of intimate portrait of an individual or group of individuals who are seeking to make a better life for themselves and often escape, you know, horrendous and circumstances. So I think it speaks to that broader narrative, and within that there's the African diaspora, which scattered across the four ends of the earth, is in a perpetual search for its own identity, its own place in the world, and very much the stepping stones from Africa to the West are seen as important steps along that story.
And that reminds me actually of what you were saying of the main protagonist in this documentary, Damani Baker's mother. Yeah. What did you make of her contribution, Mike?
It's very important that actually the bulk of the voices that you hear in this documentary are female. So it's Fanny, it's her friends and her neighbours in Granada. It's about women trying to make a life for themselves and trying to raise a family. And it's also, the film itself is the work of a son trying to pay tribute to a mother who raised him right. And I think that's why it's so emotional and so affecting at the end of the day.
I'd like to ask Sister Angela to make a few brief introductory remarks.
I'm here in Free Grenada for the very first time. The experiences that I've had here in Grenada have confirmed in a very powerful way where we are headed, what the future of the entire planet ought to look like. This beautiful, powerful militant revolution.
My sister Fania and I were so excited by what we saw. We were so struck by the enthusiasm of the not only the leaders, but the everyday people. For us, Grenada, especially for black people, really marked a new moment in history.
It just sort of captured the imagination of us. Here's a socialist government. A revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was legendary activist Angela Davis, world-renowned scholar and activist and was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, Lee, in the film, Granada was described by black people as being a sort of utopia for black people. And Maurice Bishop, the prime minister at the time, and he was tragically later shot dead, said, if we have 95% of predominantly African origin in our country, then we can have a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States. So why was there such a longing from African Americans for sort of this a strong black community and leadership?
I think very much African Americans had coming out of the Vietnam War were beginning to reassess their place in society. They'd taken part in the Olympics, they'd fought in world wars, and yet they were still facing them as horrendous police brutality and economic discrimination in the land of the home of the free and the land of the brave. Mm-hmm. And I think they'd begun to fundamentally reassess, or at least some did, reassess the extent to which they could prosper in such societies. And as all African diasporas do, they looked to elsewhere in the world where their fortunes might be greater. And of course, there's a deep longing and a sort of Garveyan sense of the Jamaican leader Marcus Garvey to build black nation, to build an example of how humanity can work together in a progressive way. And very much the ideals of Cuba and the Grenada revolutionary movement encapsulated for very many black diasporans, African diasporans, their desire to see black nationhood, to see progressive socialism encapsulated and led by, you know, not just Cuba, but joined in by other islands in and around the Caribbean. And as such, it elevated itself into a international country of appeal, mm-hmm. where the revolutionary movement put out a worldwide appeal for Africans in the diaspora to come help rebuild Grenada and be part of that movement. And lots of people from the United Kingdom, from the United States, other parts of the world responded to that call.
That's very revealing indeed. I don't think many people know about this aspect of Grenada from the black perspective.
Yeah.
And just speaking of that, Mike, I think also what's invaluable of Baker's documentaries, this archive material he has that juxtaposes sort of the propaganda, and he touches on the role of the media. Mm-hmm. What is life like? How was life painted for black people in Grenada, the reality of it?
Well, I mean, this is one of the important facets of this particular film. You get a sense of a place that is trying to, I think the phrase that Maurice Bishop uses, to throw off the Coca-Cola mentality and you know, go in a different direction. And so you do get the footage that we get here that was taken by Damani Baker's own family is very much from the ground up. You're seeing, you know, a kind of grassroots movement building. You know, you're seeing people, you know, taking control of their own destinies in a way that clearly threatened the Reagan administration. And you get this sort of strange sort of contrast between Angela Davis and that particular way of thinking and the Ronald Reagan way of thinking, which, you know, is a little, shall we say, slightly more fearful. Yeah. Yes.
Resonates a lot with today, of course.
I think so. And, you know, those contrasts, yes, do have a resonance in what's going on in America today with the way certain white leaders are espousing their values.
You're not naming any names,
Not naming any names, no.
We'll have to move swiftly on just for now.
Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All of a sudden, the drugs came in so heavy, it was scary, but it destroyed the entire city of Oakland. I mean, there's a discussion now where that came from. Entire black communities were destroyed. With all of my efforts to put you in a good school and try to balance it, there was still, we could sit on that hill in East Oakland and hear gunfire all down the hill all night.
It was very disappointing to see all the work that we've done being overrun by drugs. It was not a happy time in the black community anywhere in the States.
That was not an environment to raise children.
A little bit more of Angela Davis then. We talked a little bit about her, but I'd like to talk about her a little bit more just before we end the show. And Mike, what do you make of her contribution to this documentary?
It's very important. I mean, she turns up very early on in the film because Fanny, Damani Baker's mother, was a student of hers at the UCLA, yes, and later became her assistant. So it's almost about the role of mentoring in American life, and how having a good mentor can, you know, change the way you think about the world, change the way you perceive the world. And I think Angela Davis becomes almost Fannie's mentor, you know, and takes her to protests and leads her into a more engaged way of thinking about the world.
And the documentary sheds light on her fair share of struggle, Angela Davis, in her life for racial equality. What does she mean for black activists everywhere?
Hugely symbolic figure for black activists worldwide. Continues to be an inspiration today for the millennials who you see in the Black Lives Matter movement and wider. African women on the continent still revere Angela Davis. She's held in extraordinarily high regard right across the world. And quite rightly so, when you think about the radical stance that she took, putting herself in danger, risking jail, risking a loss of her life, all for the principled struggle for justice and equality. Angela Davis, you know, remains a very sort of bright, burning firmament on the skyline, and she will be revered, I think, for a long time to come.
And what I found inspiring, actually, from this documentary was watching her leadership and how the black unions at the time in the 80s organized. Do you think movements today can learn a lot about that era?
Well, we look at the post-Weinstein movement and the Me Too movement, and we realize just how far we've got to come. People have to realize when Angela Davis was doing what she was doing, we were talking about 1970s, late 60s America, where the kind of super black machismo was still very much of the sort of shaft, you know, militant young black man was still the focus of the struggle. And on comes Angela Davis, and in one stroke, recenters that struggle, putting black women at the heart of that movement. It was revolutionary at the time, and when you look back on it, you have to appreciate just how significant it really was.
And Mike, we're running towards the end of the show now. I just wanted to get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I found it, you know, inspirational. I found it very engaging. I also found it very educational. I mean, I've not seen much treatment, cinematic treatment, of the events in Grenada. So to have a, you know, a first-hand perspective, to have people who are actually on the ground at the time telling the story in their own words, in this very laid-back, you know, very informal way, it was an education for me.
And Lee, if I could turn to you, your final thoughts, and would you recommend this film?
Definitely recommend the film. I think that anything that captures that sort of historical narrative from the victim perspective is going to offer really unique insights for people, and also for people to get a real appreciation of how important globally the Grenadian Revolution was to Africans right across the world.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام ما يعبأ بمن يأم هذا البيت إذا لم يكن فيه ثلاث خصال: ورع يحجزه عن معاصي الله تعالى، وحلم يملك به غضبه، وحسن الصحابة لمن صحبه.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The pilgrim to his house is of no worth unless he has three attributes: piety that restrains him from acts of disobedience to Allah Most High, clemency with which he controls his anger, and good companionship with whoever accompanies him."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir has some very beautiful and interesting conversations, and via these conversations, he relays beautiful pearls of wisdom and knowledge for one and all to be able to perfect our lives and our societies. In one of these instances, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, when talking to his companions in a discussion, warns his companions and his friends, his family members, and the Muslims in general from anger. It is interesting, but Imam al-Baqir in this same conversation also provides a remedy for anger. So Imam al-Baqir, in reply to a question from his companion, where the companion must have asked, "What is anger and how do you remedy and resolve anger?" Well, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replied that indeed, surely, certainly, definitely, anger is an ember from Satan. Meaning anger is a small fire, a spark of fire, a burning ember from Satan. This burning ember is lit aflame. It is burnt in the heart of the son of Adam, meaning in the heart of a human being. And when one of you becomes angry, your eyes become red and your jugular veins become swollen out of this anger. And thus, Satan enters into that person. Meaning Satan then influences this person into do things which one wouldn't do under normal circumstances. Then Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace be upon him, says, when that person becomes angry, they must sit on the ground. Via this sitting on the ground, they are able to remove the cunning and the insinuations of Satan. So, dear friends, always try to prevent yourself from becoming angry. And of course, if you do become angry for some reason, try to keep in mind that this is Satan who is lighting a burning ember in your heart. And if via istighfar, asking for forgiveness, or if via doing some sort of dhikr, some sort of remembrance of Allah, you are not able to extinguish this fire will grow and overcome you and burn you to ashes. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
The Imam who was known for his famous title, Baqir Ulum al-Nabiyyin, somebody who spread the knowledge that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had given to the human society through the Anbiya and Mursaleen, which all had been given to the Prophet of Islam, in addition to what was given to him. And all of that, he was commanded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to pass it on to Ali, and from one imam, it goes to the other imam. The era of our fifth imam is very important to understand. When we look at the history of our imams, the first three imams, this is the era of survival for the Shia community. As far as Amir al-Mu'mineen is concerned, this was the struggle of establishing the truth of his claim about imamat, vilayat, and khilafat. And after that, we go through this challenging period during the time of the second imam, and then you see that things become even worse, culminating with the massacre in Karbala. But that was the worst that they could do. But they realized they cannot eliminate Ahlul Bayt or the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. And after that, things change. Even the strategy of the enemies change. And even the focus of the imam was now no more the issue of survival. That was already established, that this is a group and this is a mazhab which cannot be eliminated. And we have seen in the last 1400 years, you know, in many, many places in the Muslim world, the attempt has been to eliminate the Shias, but they have always come back in larger number and with even more power and prestige. And so now the second stage, when we look at the fourth imam's time and the fifth and the sixth imam, this is the era of educating the community. Because the first three imams, they did what they could do during their own times. But because, relatively speaking, the community was not still in the situation of calm and peace, they could not really sit down and go through the process of, you know, proper process of teaching and learning. And so we see that the process started with the fourth imam, but really took it more, you know, organized form during the time of the fifth imam, and that process of education and ta'lim reached to the peak during the era of the sixth imam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.